Governor Scott makes it official. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Yesterday in Orlando, Scott started his campaign to run for U.S. Senate against incumbent Bill Nelson. The governor presented himself as the outsider.
Governor, you just don't fit into Tallahassee. You know, I think that's true.
Also on the program, we're going to talk with Anita Carl. She's a Holocaust survivor who frequently shares her powerful story with young people. We hear her tale in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day coming up this week. Finally, we'll talk to the woman who represented the U.S. in dealings with Cuba back in the 90s, culminating in the Elian Gonzalez saga. All of that coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the worst-kept secret in Florida went public yesterday. Governor Rick Scott is running for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate.
If you go to Tallahassee and you make real change, guess what happens? The political insiders, the first thing they are, they're mad at you. And they say, Governor, you just don't fit into Tallahassee. You know, I think that's true.
Well, he's challenging the incumbent, Bill Nelson, a Democrat, with us on Skype to discuss the Senate race. Is Sergio Bustos, senior editor of Politico Florida. Sergio, great to have you back.
Thank you for the invitation.
All right, so why did it take Governor Scott up to this point to announce what pretty much everyone in the state had been expecting for a pretty long time?
Well, I think he was just waiting to finish up the legislative session, not to mention following the Parkland shooting that also had to get dealt with. So once that was cleared away and he was ready to roll, I mean, I don't think it was anything unusual. There was no one was going to challenge him in the primary anyway. So,
yeah. So there is no primary challenge for him.
No, there won't be. Not with the money he's bringing and the name recognition. No, this was all a done deal.
All right. The current Senator Bill Nelson is running for his fourth term. How does Governor Scott compare to other challengers that Nelson has had?
I think this Governor Scott will be his biggest challenge because of the name recognition, the money, the backing of the big party. I think he'll of the Republican Party, I should say, the GOP. I think he'll have I think he represents probably the biggest challenge Nelson has had in these statewide races.
All right. So how good are both Scott and Nelson at campaigning? What do you expect to see?
If you are sitting at home with a television set, you might want to take a hiatus because you are going to be bombarded with television ads, especially if you lived up in the I-4 corridor up in central Florida. That's kind of the swing district of the swing region of the swing state. There's going to be a parade of advertising because there's so much money here that could be spent well over $100 million in advertising. And keep in mind, the election is only we're here April, just a few months. So it's all the TV is going to be wall to wall. And then if you go online, you're also going to see a lot of ads there too.
You know what? We always hear what an expensive state Florida is to run in. Are we talking about setting any campaign spending records in this race?
Oh, yeah. I think some estimates could go as high as $200 million, but it should be well over $100 million. It's an important race. Democrats want it. Republicans want it. And keep in mind, the Senate, the U.S. Senate's only a couple votes apart with Republicans lead 51 to 49.
Is Rick Scott likely to pay for this himself? Is this self-funded?
You know, he did that the first round when he came in as a political newcomer back in 2010. But then he got a lot of help in 2014 when he was running for re-election. But what it does give him, and this is the edge, is in that 2014 race, that last week of the campaign against Charlie Crist, Scott dug into his own wallet and paid for a bunch of ads that I think might have pushed him over the top that weekend. And this is something that worries Democrats as well, because he knows he's got the deep pockets to fund them. And so Democrats and Nelson are going to have to come up with money from the rest of the party, the rest of the country, to help pave his way. And again, it's going to be a very expensive race.
All right, so Governor Scott has pretty systematically actually been moving to the middle this year, most notably by supporting gun control after the Parkland shooting. I mean, what Rick Scott are we going to see?
You know, it's interesting with Governor Scott. He's evolved from the beginning. Remember, he came in as a Tea Party, with a Tea Party wave, you know, and talking about being an outsider and all this, just like he did yesterday. Although it's going to be hard for him to do that because he's now been in office. He's been a, quote, politician for now 8 years. So he can't really make that argument of being an outsider. I think his angle there is that he'll be an outsider in Washington. I think that'll be his kind of his play there. But really, he's got a record to run on now, and that's going to be taken apart by Bill Nelson and the Democratic Party.
All right. Still, President Trump has been very outspoken about his support for the idea of a Senator Scott, and Scott has been a very good political friend to the president. Are we going to see the president campaigning in Florida for Governor Scott?
It'll be interesting to see if he does, because this race between Governor Scott and Senator Nelson is as much a race between two well-known candidates as it is a referendum on the Trump presidency. Whether Trump comes down to campaign, you know, he hasn't really done a lot of that, and when he did it in Alabama, it didn't do very well in that special election. In fact, you know, he caused a little chaos there when he was in between the Republican candidates down there in the primary. But I do think you might see him, but it's hard to tell. Scott said yesterday in his announcement that he's his own person. He's Rick Scott. He's not tethered to anyone. But in fact, you know, you'd be really stretched. It'd be hard to believe that if Rick Scott didn't get up to Washington, he wouldn't be lockstep in with the Trump administration on almost every issue.
What do you see?
And that's what voters have to decide.
Yeah. What do you see as the divisive issue in this campaign?
You know, it's always hard to predict, and I hate to get in that business because I've been wrong before. And you know, with campaigns and elections, you really got to focus in those last few weeks because you know what can happen. Another, you know, God forbid, another Parkland shooting. You never know what issue is going to rise to the front. But there are a few that are definitely going to be at the top of the agenda here. And one of them is gun safety, gun control, whatever you want to call it. If the Parkland students, those Marjorie Stoneman and Douglas students, do mobilize folks, it would be a big step to bring the young people out to vote and make it a really high turnout election.
What do you think? Go ahead.
No, so you're talking about gun control, gun safety. You know, this tax bill that kind of snuck in at the end of December, giving everyone a tax break, I'm not sure that's resonated with people yet, and I wonder if it will pop up later as Americans see that the deficit's going up, the debt continues to climb, whether that becomes an issue. But, you know, like most elections, it all comes down to the economy, and if the economy's humming, it might help. But, you know, Trump's negative numbers are so low, or so high, I should say, that he's just going to be a major factor overshadowing the whole race.
Well, yeah, I was wondering, like, what's the weakness for each candidate? If you say this one thing that is going to hurt Scott, is going to hurt Nelson, what is it?
One thing that would hurt Scott, I think, is he just has a tendency of sticking so close to his talking points. It served him well, no doubt. But in a statewide campaign like this one, again, against Senator Nelson, that kind of approach, I think, is going to hurt him when he's trying to talk about certain issues like gun control and the like. His flip-flop on oil drilling off the Atlantic coast, off the Florida coast, it's going to come back to him. I know Nelson and Democrats have already harped on that. So you got gun control because he's turned around on that, oil drilling, Those are the two that could hurt him. On Nelson's side, I think with Nelson, it's a matter of, you know, he made a gaffe the other day here with talking about what had happened in Liberty City with the shooting. Things like that could get him into trouble. Also, he's just not a very charismatic candidate. You know, he doesn't draw your attention. He's been winning statewide office for years, but, you know, are the Democrats, younger Democrats, going to see him as someone viable that they want to keep in office? A lot of things are at stake for him, but I think for him it's going to come down to his ability to excite Democrats to get out to vote.
All right, let me finish up on this, because you brought up the Stoneman-Douglas students and really their energy, their activism. What role do you think they're going to play in this? You know, they've been merciless on social media, but what do you think they may be in this election?
Lewis, social media is one thing, and I understand it, and I'm older. I'm 55 myself. I do use Twitter and Facebook and the like. But, you know, it all comes down to voting on election day. So you can tweet all you want, you can do as many likes as you want on Facebook, but if people do not show up to vote on election day, it's not going to matter. So what's going to be critical for the young vote, at least, is keep this in mind. In 2016, roughly 46% of young people, 18 to 29, voted. The number, the percentage that voted that were 65 and older was closer to 72%, 71%. If they can close that gap, young voters could have a voice in this November.
It'll be an interesting, you know, view for this election. Some of those students still not old enough to vote, but they may play a role if they are that active on social media. Again, talking with Sergio Busto, senior editor of Politico Florida. He joined us via Skype. Sergio, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
All right, still to come, an amazing, harrowing story of escape and survival. It's Holocaust Memorial Day this week. We'll share that story coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. So tomorrow is the beginning of Yom HaShoah, or International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Anita Carl is one of the youngest survivors of the Holocaust, living in Miami, and her family's escape from a ghetto in Nazi-occupied Poland is truly inspiring. Carl regularly shares her story at Jewish community centers, universities, and high schools, and she's going to be giving a talk in Miami Beach tomorrow. And Anita Carl joins us now in studio. It is such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with your story. You were very young when you were living in, and please help me with the name of the city you were living in.
It's Lwów.
Lwów, okay.
In Poland.
In Poland. Then the Nazis showed up.
The Nazis came in, invaded Poland in 1939, but came to our city, Lwów, in 1941. Immediately they settled a ghetto in a poor part of the city, and all the Jewish population was forced to go there.
How would you describe to people what the city of Lwów was like before the Nazis arrived?
Before the Nazis came, it was a very large cosmopolitan city, a very intellectual city. It had the opera house, theaters, schools, and many, many people who lived there were Jewish and others were not. The Jewish people lived comfortably among the Gentiles and for many years had no problems.
And as you said, they came in, they created a ghetto, and they forced the Jewish people to
yes.
move to this ghetto.
Yes.
What now, you had a certain type of life, and then all of a sudden your family, you had to live in this ghetto. How do you describe what that was like? What was the ghetto like?
That was a very, very terrible times for us, because the life as I knew it disappeared suddenly. And I was forced to live in a place that was a man-made hell, where it was easier to die than to live. And people perished from hunger, from many diseases, and were murdered by the Nazis without any reason or provocation.
Were you with your entire family?
I was at the beginning with my entire family, which was a very large family. My mother was one of 10 and my father one of 6. And we were 3 sisters, 3 little girls. And we had hunger. We suffered from hunger. We suffered from the weather. In Poland, the winters are very, very cold. And it was simply difficult to live.
Now, at some point, your mother said, we have to get out of here.
When the law to murder all the children came, just before they were doing the transfers to the concentration camps, my mother said she would not stand by and watch her children being murdered. So she made a plan, and we escaped from the ghetto after 2 years of living in this inferno, in this hell. And against all odds, we escaped. We took off everything that would identify us as Jews. We took a train to the southern part of Poland, and my life as a Catholic girl began. My mother sought refuge in the church.
You said your mother had a plan. How did you guys get past the Nazis, the Nazi guards, and all, because you had to run into a lot of them?
This was in December. It was very, very cold. And the Nazis, although they looked on the perimeter of the ghetto, but at night, sometimes they fell asleep. And it was not expected of anyone to try this plan to try to escape, because people were afraid, people were cold and hungry. The Germans were armed and they were well fed and they were protected from the climate. But we were lucky. Somehow God was looking over us. And my mother was a very, very brave and courageous woman. And she gave us life again. And she escaped to life with the 3 little girls.
And sadly, what happened to your father?
My father was murdered, as all the rest of my family was. All my aunts, my uncles, from a family of close to 300 people. No one survived. In the ghetto, there were 150,000 Jews. Only 200 survived, and I am one of them. The ghetto of Lviv and the Janowska concentration camp next door, that was a slave labor camp, was everyone was exterminated. Everyone who lived beyond illnesses, sicknesses, and hunger was gassed and burned in the extermination camps.
How did you and your family make it to the United States?
We first made it to Lima, Peru. After the war, the American came and they had protected us a little bit, and they helped us in the DP camps. And the brother of my father, the eldest brother, who had been a doctor in Vienna, and in 1938 was told that according to the Nuremberg laws, he was not allowed to practice medicine. So he left Vienna, and Peru gave him a visa. And so he settled in Peru. He was a bachelor, and he found us after the war in Germany in one of the DP camps and asked my mother to come to Peru. And there he took care of us, educated us, eventually married my mother, and we had finally a wonderful family.
And you say DP camps, those are displaced persons.
camps. Yes.
There was a part of your story that was fascinating. Again, you're very young when all this is happening, that your mother, one of the ways she protected you is that basically was saying that you guys, you're Christians.
That's right. We learned how to be Catholic. And from the very beginning, when we arrived in Buchach, we started every Sunday to go to church. No one was allowed to know that we were Jews because the Polish people would persecute us also, and they would tell the Germans that we were a Jewish family. So we were not allowed to know that we are Jewish. Slowly I forgot being Jewish, and my world was a Catholic world where I went to Sunday Mass. I had one dress, a white dress for church, and one pair of shoes for Sundays. And so I began to love this new religion, and I felt very comfortable in it. And till today, I have in my heart a little spot for my Jewish friends and my Jewish religion. I remember Christmases were so beautiful. So after I was told I am Jewish, I still wanted my Christmas tree. And my mother brought me one, and I had to promise that it was the last time.
Yeah, because so when you were children, I mean, at one point you just thought you were
right,
Catholics.
We were convinced. I was convinced. And so today, if a friend, a neighbor is dressing a Christmas tree, I offer to help always.
You know, I'm thinking about, I get the opportunity from time to time to talk with people like you who have lived through this horrible part of history, but it's fascinating because there's so many lessons that we can learn, that you tried, and you're still so active in trying to share these stories because you want especially young people to learn something.
Yes, I lecture at schools and the colleges and in many places. I also have taken on a program that is called the March of the Living, where we go, after I tell them the story, we go to Poland and we visit for 1 week all the places, the extermination camps, where 6 million of our brothers and sisters were murdered, of which 1.5 million were children. And these young seniors usually learn what I told them. They see it in person and they can connect to our past. Because if we do not look at our past, we may not have a future.
When was the first time you did that march?
3 years ago, and I have gone twice. Okay. And God willing, next year I shall go again.
For you, you want to share these stories to pass on this wisdom in hoping that younger generations gain something and that none of that is lost. But what is it like for you? In that you have to, because now you're talking about going back and reliving these memories.
Every time. For me, it is very difficult, but I do it from my heart in the hope that they will never forget me, nor they will forget my story. It's a story of heroism that my mother accomplished, where she had to choose to save the life of her husband or the lives of her 3 children. And they chose the life of the children so we can be witnesses to this blackest time in the story of humanity, not only of Judaism, but of humanity. Because when humanity forgets to be human, and forgets compassion, then we are lost. We should never allow this to happen again. And that's why we must learn and remember it forever.
When you take these folks on the march, when you take them to Poland and you show them these places, typically what do they say to you? What are some of the things they experience that they share with you?
First of all, it is unbelievable for them or anyone who goes to these camps and sees what happened and how it happened and the cruelty and evil that rained upon us. It is difficult to see the mountains of belongings that the Germans took away. The shoes of little children, they are still there. The Germans used our hair to make mattresses. They used our skin to make lamps. And they used our bones for fertilizers. So these crimes against humanity shall never be forgotten.
You know, we defeated the Nazis in World War II, but we find ourselves now in this very interesting, weird time where we see that symbol and we see the name Nazis, neo-Nazis is what they call themselves today. We see the little moments of what Nazi symbolism was. When you see that today, what do you think?
I think that they are ignorant people above everything else, because with a little bit of education and knowledge of why and how it happened, and if they only visited these places, they would think in another way. I am convinced that mainly it is ignorance.
How have your mother's actions, you talk about her heroism, how has that changed, or how did that impact, I should say, really as you were growing up and the woman that you became and now what you're doing with your life?
We were very, very proud, my sisters and I, of my mother always. We admired her and we cherished her. We knew she gave us life twice. And for us, she's the symbol of our people. She is a heroine of our people. Maybe a silent heroine, but yet she is a heroine of our people. She saved three lives from the Holocaust.
What ways can people support the continuation of Jewish traditions and education around Holocaust? What can we do, these other generations, in helping?
The best help of all is to study and to educate oneself on the subject. And as we have, thank God, in Florida, studies on the Holocaust in every school. So by doing that, we shall not forget, and we will remember.
You brought something with you, and after the program, we want to do a quick Facebook Live with you because you have some photos with you, but you also brought a book, and I wanted you were pointing it out to me before we started, but this is a book about your mother.
Yes, my mother wrote the book when she was close to 80 years old. She decided to do that as a testimony for the children, for the three of us. And so she wrote this fabulous book called Escape to Life. It was written in Lima, so it is in Spanish, although it was translated into English, but yet unpublished. The book is about what we went through and about her history and the history of her family and my family. And it was edited three times in South America under great reviews, and it was sold out the three times. Today the book is sold out, but we are trying to publish it once more.
And, you know, did she write it specifically for you and your sisters?
Yes, she did. She was not a writer, but yet it is written with such heart and feeling that you cannot put it down. It is not a big book, and it was never intended to be what it became, a bestseller.
Now, as I mentioned, you are going to be giving a speech. You're going to be talking tomorrow in Miami Beach, correct?
Yes.
What, when you have these opportunities, especially for a day like Yom HaShoah, what is it that you want to convey to people? What is it you're trying to tell them?
I tell the people that in the end, although we suffered so much, in the end we won. We were not defeated because our people are eternal.
And again, that event is coming up tomorrow. It's, I believe it is at the Michael N. Russell JCC.
Yes.
What time?
At 10:30.
10:30. You know what, Anita, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate the time. I appreciate you, sharing the story. It is a sad story, but it's a powerful story and such an important one. And I'm glad that you came in and had the opportunity to share it with us, because somebody hears that and they, as you said, education is the most important thing.
Thank you very much.
All right. Don't go anywhere, because after the show, we're going to talk again, okay?
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Again, Anita Carl, one of the youngest survivors of the Holocaust, living here in Miami and sharing this powerful story with us. We'll have more information and details of her event tomorrow, her speech tomorrow, on our Facebook page. You can find it at WLRN. Sundial. Well, still to come, it's 18 years to this month since the night Miami was rocked when federal officials took away a child named Ilian Gonzalez. We're going to look at what was going on in U.S.-Cuba relations back then. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, if Ken Burns could do a multi-series documentary on the love-hate relationship between the U.S. and Cuba, well, you'd imagine that would be a long series. And, of course, one of the people that he would have to talk to in that series would have to be Vicki Huddleston. She was, for a time, the principal officer for the U.S. in Havana. She was not a full ambassador since neither country opened their embassies back in the 90s when she was in the post. She has a new book out, sharing stories of her time working with Cuba. It's called Our Woman in Havana, A Diplomat's Chronicle of America's Long Struggle with Castro's Cuba. Now, she's going to be at the Books and Books in Coral Gables, and that is today. And Vicki, you told me a different time, and I went on their calendar. They have you set up at 8 o'clock.
You're kidding.
Okay, so
wow.
you said it's at 4.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to see if we can verify that information. Again, I was just looking at the Books and Books calendar, but it is your event, so you would know. And
well, I'm glad I'm here so we can get it straightened out.
Yes, we'll try to get that straightened out, but I'm glad to have you here. When's the first time you stepped foot in Cuba?
In 1989, probably in the summer of 1989, I was Deputy Director of Cuban Affairs at the Department of State, and I went down to Cuba to get acquainted with the intersection, which, of course, was our ersatz embassy, and to meet a few of the Cuban officials and to travel around the country a little bit.
How would you describe at that point? And some people, who are listening were alive. They would remember.
I hope so.
Yeah, but how would you describe, as a reminder, what U.S.-Cuba relationship was like then?
At that point in 89, it was still pretty much the Cold War. So you had the Cuban-American National Foundation that was pushing hard for television Martí. We only had radio Martí at that point. The Cuban people were sort of afraid to talk to American officials. There was literally no business going on in Cuba, no private business whatsoever. And then the Cubans began to suffer quite a bit, a lot, because you come into the special period. And not only do they lose the $5 billion in Soviet subsidies, but we enact the Cuba democracy, which cuts off a lot of food and medicine that was coming from Latin America, from U.S. subsidiaries. And so Cubans are really in a desperate, desperate situation. And of course, back here in the United States, Cuban Americans are thinking Christmas in Havana, which, of course, not the case.
And you had mentioned it, too, because around this time, the Soviet Union is basically collapsed, and so their support to Cuba had ended, and so now there's a question of what will Cuba do next. And as you said, there were Cubans here in Florida thinking, maybe this is finally the end of the Castros. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You met, reading through this first meeting you had with Fidel Castro, there were actually a couple of African nations in Havana at the time. There was a signing that was going on. This is the first time you met Castro.
Yes, yes.
What was that like?
Aha. Uh-huh. So this was a meeting that I'll never forget, and I love to tell the story. So thank you, Luis. What happened is I had just been promoted to the director of Cuban Affairs, and our delegation from Africa, the diplomat, our American diplomats at the State Department who were from the Africa Bureau were going down because it was the completion of the tripartite engagements. And this is President H.W. Bush was responsible. And the tripartite agreements had brought back 50,000 Cuban troops from Angola and also the troops in Ethiopia, which in those days, that was the big problem. It was sort of like, if that problem can be solved, then the relationship between our two countries can improve. But then the Soviet Union began to crumble, and this hope in Miami and in the exile community began to seem to be realized. Of course, it wasn't. Anyway, back to the story. So I went to this great gala hosted by Fidel Castro, and during the treaty signing, which seemed to go on forever, Fidel was kind of moving around and was really bored, and I happened to catch his eye, and I thought, well, that's probably a mistake, because what happened shortly thereafter is he walked over to our delegation.
And he went straight to you.
Straight to me. The head of our delegation was a big guy. It was Jeff Davidow, tried to intercept him, but he didn't want to talk to Jeff Davidow, who might even be bigger than Fidel was. So he looks at me and he says, "Who are you? Someone's spouse?" I was so annoyed, because I absolutely know he knew who I was, since I'd been in Cuba often over the past 2 years. So I stand
now
up.
Admit that at that moment you wanted to snap back.
I did.
That's a massive insult.
Of course it is. Yeah. Especially in that time.
Yeah.
You know, spouses are working more today. So I snap back. I say, "No, I'm the director of Cuban Affairs." And Castro gets this sort of Cheshire cat grin on his face, and he waits till all the diplomatic delegations that are there from around the world are listing, and then he booms out, "Oh, I thought I was."
You know, I was thinking about this is I mean, there was a dinner was going on that night, and there was a buffet, and there was more confrontation with Castro.
More confrontation, but what I always thought, thank God there was no cell phones, because Fidel waited at the door for me, and then he puts out his arm, and I took it. And we walk into dinner leading all the diplomats. And, you know, you could literally hear the,
You're walking arm in arm with Fidel Castro. And you knew, and you said it, because if there were cell phones, because the Cuban diaspora back here in Florida, if they had seen that, it would have been devastating.
Finish for me.
I wouldn't
have had a job, and President Bush, H.W. Bush, would have had to deny that. Well, you know, in the second chapter of my book, there is that kind of thing that happened with the Cuban diaspora.
Right.
And the only way I kept my job is Jorge Mascanosa, the president of CANAF, interceded on my behalf.
And what I'll say to that is that, yeah, you had done an interview, with the Sun Sentinel? And somebody did an interview with the Miami Herald.
My boss, Miami Herald.
And it caused a very big, and I'm not going to give it away, read the book, but it caused this big uproar in the community here in Miami.
The second part of the interview was that this one, Castro was serious. They pushed all the diplomats over to the far side of the room, and Castro and I and his lovely interpreter were on the other side. And of course, Castro had waited till I filled my plate up, So I was definitely disadvantaged holding silverware and plate. And before I can even get close to him, he's going, el bloqueo, está matando los niños. And, oh!
And you snap back again.
Yes, and I told him, I said, look, if you want to get rid of what is the embargo, not a blockade, then you have to have free and fair elections with international observations. Then he starts on another track. So this went on for a while, and it seemed as if he were probing for the possibility that at least if there wasn't going to be an opening, at least we wouldn't harden the embargo. Because after all, we had been part of the negotiations, and it probably was the case, but I certainly couldn't prove it, that we had said, like, well, you know, if you sign these agreements and live up to them, then, you know, possibly relations could improve. You know, you can kind of get that feel. So he was hoping that HW wouldn't endorse or sign in to law the Cuban democracy. And of course, I couldn't say anything about that. So Fidel finishes the conversation. He walks off. I walk off. And then he grabs this big martini with a great olive in it straight up off the the tray and downs it. And I pour myself a bit of 100-year-old rum.
As you described in the book, he looked angry. He looked perturbed because he went after you specifically, because you had described him as someone who he was always looking for that one person he thought would be the weakest that he could go after to show his superiority. He thought it would be you.
Well, and also, you know, he's so charismatic, and you notice he always did women interviews, like Barbara Walters, the most famous one, of course. Mm-hmm. And so I think Fidel always figured his charm would overwhelm any woman he ever met.
So I want to move forward in the book a little bit. You were in this post for a number of years, and then you left and became an ambassador for other countries. Then under President Bill Clinton, you came back to playing a big role in the U.S.-Cuba relationship.
Yes, that's when I went to Havana as the head of the intersection. Castro would say the jefe de la sección de intereses, because he called us the sección de intereses, SINA, because it sounds like CIA, CIA, when our name was the United States Intersection. And that's not a true translation, obviously.
Right, right.
But he was very clever about his strategy, obviously, and dealing with the United States. And it seemed to me that, you know, at times he did want the relationship to improve, but he didn't want it so bad that he wouldn't take advantage right. of an opportunity. And that's what Elian Gonzalez was.
I was fascinated by this section of the book because you look at what was going on. First, the way that you laid out the way each president was handling Fidel Castro and the Cuban situation. So you go from George H.W. to Bill Clinton and how he was handling it. Then all of a sudden, Elian Gonzalez arrives in Florida. And it was really what I was fascinated most by was this back and forth between Clinton and Castro. You get the call, you got to go to D.C. Here's this young boy who's now, you know, in the United States living with family in Miami. This is at the point with the, you know, we had the basically Cubans arrive, they stay. But this was a different situation. His father back in Cuba wants him back, and Fidel uses this. And now the president, President Clinton, is now stuck.
He's very stuck.
He's stuck. What was going on at that time? What did you think about the whole thing? What should have happened to this boy?
Oh, well, you know, this is such a ridiculous, in a way, situation. And I know that that's kind of a harsh word. But it seemed as if everybody did the wrong thing. And Fidel took complete advantage of it. Clinton was trying to do an opening. He had the people-to-people. And so he was hoping, and he had negotiators standing by in the wings and Casey saw this opportunity. Gabriel Garcia Marquez had been involved. So this was Clinton trying to open. And then this little child, put on an inner tube by his mother, ends up in Miami. And the Cuban diaspora, Jorge Mas Santos now, the son of Jorge Mas Canosa, is the new head of CANAF. And I think in some ways this was the opportunity for Santos to show, look, I can really run this organization.
So he was a powerful Cuban here in the United States. Was he also the one that was thinking that Castro was gone, he was going to go to Cuba?
That was Mas Canosa.
That was Mas Canosa,
his father.
That's correct. Yes.
And then this is the son who's going to prove himself. And so, I have no idea who thought it would be a good idea to say we're going to keep this cute little child.
And when everything went down, and I went back, and I hadn't seen this in years, I went back and watched the video. You had federal agents drive into this community. A lot of Cuban Americans already there on the streets. They were throwing things. They rush into the house. There's the famous photo, of course, of Elian being pulled out of the closet at gunpoint. I mean, all this happens. What, you know, because of your position, what did you think was going to happen? Like, great, now whatever relations we had, I mean, you know, what was going through your mind at that time?
When that moment of the agent with the gun in full flak armor is confronting Dalrymple and Ellie in the closet was just like, oh no, it couldn't get worse. I mean, now obviously the Cuban diaspora are going to feel like they've been punished by the U.S. government and their child has been taken away. It's just like it couldn't be worse. And I also knew that moment signified the end of Clinton's attempt at opening.
And do you think this is what destroyed Al Gore's chance for president? Because the Cuban community basically just threw the blame on him for what Clinton did.
Exactly. And Gore had been sort of wishy-washy on this. You know, he had sort of indicated that he didn't agree with Clinton, but he didn't want to go too far. And so what you see happen is that Clinton got 30% of the vote, when Cuban American vote, in his second run for election. Gore got 18%. I mean, 20% would have been like the norm, but Bill Clinton had been effective in courting the Cuban American community to include endorsing the Cuban Democracy Act. So had Al Gore just gotten 500 more votes, he would have won the election. And clearly, el voto castigo, the punishment vote of the Cuban Americans, prevented Gore from getting the votes he needed.
I had the sense reading through it that it was like this international chess match, and Fidel used it, and he used it actually really effectively and pounced Clinton pretty much on that. What do you think of what's going on now? We look back at President Obama, what he did, opened things up, went down there to Havana and was seen with Raul Castro. And Raul Castro says he's stepping down. What do you think of the last few years in U.S.-Cuba relations?
I think it's a tragedy what's going on now. President Obama had the right idea. And in fact, we saw a considerable number of reforms in Cuba. 500,000 Cubans, Cuenta Propista, self-employed. We saw amazing amount of space being created in Cuba. It wasn't the same country that I described when I went down in 89. You have people in the street selling all sorts of souvenirs. You have private restaurants. You have young people with bands involved in the internet. You have cell phones. You know, I'm not describing a perfect country or a free
country.
But
it's just different. It's
but
just
it
very different.
Was much more open. And Castro was moving ahead with those reforms. Now he's pulling them back. Just at the time, the most historic moment I think we've had in Cuba, when there's going to be a change to a non-Castro president.
All right. Oh, I'm out of time. I want to talk more about this with you. But again, your new book is Our Woman in Havana, A Diplomat's Chronicle of America's Long Struggle with Castro's Cuba, Vicki Huddleston. Now, Vicki, we checked. So let's check on this. We checked with Books and Books. You're vented at 8 o'clock.
Wow.
Okay, at 8 o'clock tonight in the Coral Gable, so we'll get to that. I have to stop there because of time. Vicki, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Luis. Thank you for getting the right time, 8 o'clock.
That's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.